danger?
Well, we don't know all the details at all. All we know is that they were willing to talk with the, or find ways to talk with the captors, and thus find a commonality, a way to get their hostages released. But however, our government finds that problematic because, of course, large sums of money were exchanged in these negotiations, which, of course, funds the terrorism and the continued kidnapping. So this is a very complex problem. There were a lot of disconnects, and that is partly why this is one of our major campaigns, Amy. There were, issues, problems. But again, we want to be part of that solution, Amy. And we're seeing some progress, some real progress, in a very complicated situation, very complex, dangerous world. So that is what is making us hopeful.
It is 5 o'clock p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The 5 o'clock news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival series at the Hollywood Theater. The film this month is Sunu, screening Thursday, February 11th at 7:30 p.m. in its U.S. premiere. Seen through the eyes of small, mid-size, and large Mexican maize producers, Sunu knits together different stories from a threatened rural world. Sunu reveals how maize and everything it gives life to could be lost forever, and how we all could lose the capability to make important choices unless we act soon. Edna Vasquez will perform before the film. Again, that's the U.S. premiere of Sunu as part of the Portland Eco Film Festival on Thursday, February 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Youth Summit, taking place February 12th and February 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club in Portland. February 12th will feature a workshop called Healing Ourselves to Raise Our Future, and a performance by spoken word artist S. Renee Mitchell. February 13th will feature workshops on topics ranging from becoming an MC to healthy living to information on going to Africa. That evening, the summit will close with a youth talent showcase. Again, that's the Portland Youth Summit, February 12th and 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club, 5250 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there will be a ballot measure proposal to reduce the prison population in California.
Linn County commissioners challenged the governor's plan to raise the minimum wage.
And an update on the spread of the mosquito-borne Zika virus.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 28th, 2016. I'm Sarika Mehta.
I'm Robert Barncord. There are now only a handful of remaining armed protesters in the ongoing occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Protester David Fry stated in a YouTube post that one man abandoned the refuge this morning, leaving only four holdouts. In that same YouTube video, Fry acknowledged that the remaining occupiers were negotiating with the FBI to peacefully end the occupation. He claimed that federal officials had promised three of the four remaining men were free to leave without fear of arrest as long as they passed through official checkpoints and identified themselves. However, the fourth man, presumed to be Sean Anderson of Riggins, Idaho, has a warrant for the felony charge of conspiracy to interfere with federal employees, the same charge that Ammon Bundy and 10 other occupiers have been arrested for. The four remaining occupiers have stated that, unless the charge against Anderson is dropped, they refuse to leave the refuge. Aside from the 11 arrests so far, five men have left the refuge through checkpoints and have been released without charge. Distrust about assurances of clemency has flared after one of the last leaders of the occupation, Jason Patrick, was arrested at a checkpoint after claiming to have been told he could go free. This misunderstanding has been seen by the occupiers and other supportive Patriot militia groups as a betrayal of trust by the FBI and has resulted in a broad call by the Pacific Patriot Network for the presence of other militias to support the remaining occupiers. The Pacific Patriot Network claims to have a protest planned in the nearby town of Burns for this Saturday. Another militia network, Operation Mutual Defense, which operates out of California, released a similar request after the fatal traffic stop on Tuesday, but has, of this morning, retracted it with the belief that support would only come too late and would be dangerous. The eight occupiers initially arrested during Tuesday's traffic stop were charged yesterday with felony counts of conspiracy to interfere with federal employees. Three other men who were subsequently arrested faced similar charges. Ammon Bundy's lawyer released a statement from his client urging the remaining protesters to leave the refuge peacefully.
The Board of Commissioners of Oregon's Linn County wrote to Governor Kate Brown yesterday to voice their opposition to the minimum wage increase. Spearheaded by the board's chairman, Roger Nyquist, Linn County asserted that the minimum wage proposal is unconstitutional because it doesn't include funding to help put the wage increase into play. In the letter, Chairman Nyquist said that many local businesses would be able to undercut the new minimum wage scale, driving businesses away from county services and to private competitors. The projected figures show that this could cost Linn County an estimated $2.25 million in revenue that it can't afford to lose. Governor Brown's proposal will have the city of Portland's minimum wage increased to $15.52 and the rest of Oregon's to $13.50 by the year 2022. This grievance follows another submitted to the state of Oregon earlier this month regarding a $1.4 billion class action lawsuit that Linn County has begun assembling to recover lost logging profits. That lawsuit, if filed, will draw on a 70-year-old contract and argue that the state de-emphasized logging in over 800,000 acres of state trust lands. The Oregon Department of Education released its latest numbers on this past year's graduation rate, which improved slightly over previous years. An average of 74% of high schoolers from the class of 2015 graduated in 4 years, an increase of 2% from last year. In recent years, educators across the state have zeroed in on specific goals to help students succeed and exit the public high school system with a degree. This year's improvements are due to a renewed attention to closing achievement and opportunity gaps, promoting a college-going culture, and using an array of programs to more actively engage students in their studies of interest. According to today's data, despite significant rises across wide demographic lines, chronic student absenteeism in the classroom continues to be a huge challenge in raising Oregon's comparatively low graduation rates.
The price of gas may be increasing for Portland drivers. The Portland City Council approved a proposal for a 10-cent gas tax today. Voters will have a chance to vote on this tax in this May's election. The gas tax was proposed by Commissioner Steve Novick last fall in an effort to raise money to fix Portland's crumbling roads. If approved by voters, it'll begin in September of 2016 and will remain in place for 4 years. The new tax would raise an estimated $16 million per year. According to city studies, more than half of Portland's roads are in disrepair, and Portland's roads are in such poor condition that it could take close to $1 billion to fix the roads that are in need of maintenance. Critics of the gas tax point out that the proposed tax will not apply to heavy-duty diesel fuel trucks, which, if taxed, could bring in millions more in revenue.
Local air quality regulators joined the list of petitioners taking legal action against the Southern California Gas Company yesterday. They allege that negligence has been the cause of the methane leak that began last October. That leak isn't expected to be contained until the end of February. The gas utility is a subsidiary of Sempra Energy, and according to data at Open Secrets, seven members of Congress are shareholders. Between lobbying expenditures and campaign contributions, the company has spent more than $30 million influencing Washington since 1992. Dr. Astrid Caldas is the expert on climate change at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about the impact the leak is having on climate change projections. She also discussed what changes in regulatory policy
might be. Can you share with our listeners the dynamics of climate change in general and how the threshold of 350 parts per million as a ratio is something we should not surpass?
Well, we have already surpassed that. Unfortunately, the dynamics is very simple. The higher the concentration of these gases that we call greenhouse gases, which are the gases that absorb energy from the sun into our atmosphere, the higher their concentration, the more they are going to absorb energy of the sun, and therefore the temperatures are going to keep rising. So concentrations are usually measured in parts per million, and these are the concentrations that you were talking about the 350. Unfortunately, 400 has already been surpassed for carbon dioxide in 2014.
And based on what I've been able to learn, we're adding 2 parts per million per year?
Depending on who you talk to, give or take. Sometimes they say it's more, sometimes they say it's less, depending on the calculations. But ideally, we shouldn't be adding any. That would be the ideal world, but that's not going to happen for quite a while.
Because I've seen reports suggesting that this leak in Porter Ranch has emitted the equivalent of 2.1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, or more than 440,000 cars can emit over a year's time.
That is correct. Actually, the updated numbers as of today are 2.2, not 2.1 anymore, and it's 2.2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents. And that's as of yesterday, so the report came up today. That is quite a bit. That is very significant locally. But if you put it into perspective, into the grand scheme of things, within California, within the United States, and within the global numbers, it is not a huge amount, comparatively speaking, in terms of absolute and relative amount. However, it is important because of the higher effect that methane can have on the warming of the atmosphere, methane being the main component of the natural gas leak.
I find myself curious as to whether it poses a greater risk on the short term at ground level, or is it more dangerous once it gets up into the atmosphere on the long term?
There are two issues to consider there. The local health issue, because the gases themselves are not considered toxic, but they do cause some reactions like nausea and vomiting because of the strong smells that are added to the methane, which is naturally a substance that doesn't have any odor. So for you to identify, you have to add these substances. So the smell is quite strong. So these reactions can be very bad. There's one substance that can be carcinogenic in the long term at very high concentrations, but the health board has not found these concentrations to be as high as to pose a health risk yet. The other issue is once that methane is up in the air, it is already in the atmosphere. A meter above surface is already the atmosphere. So once it's out there, it's already in the atmosphere. So in the short term, methane has a much higher degree of warming rate than carbon dioxide. So because this is methane, in the short term, it can account for more of the cumulative warming that is measured locally in the United States and globally. The effects are not going to be felt in a week or a month. The effects are cumulative. There are air circulations. It's a global thing. So that methane is going to be spread all over the place. So the effect is going to be such that it will influence global warming more in the short term than in the long term because methane life in the atmosphere is about 12 years. And it warms 35 times more than carbon dioxide. So living 12 years and warming the atmosphere 25 times more than carbon dioxide, you can see that this can be a significant issue.
Do you know what's been done to try and plug this leak, which I believe is now in its 12th week?
They have started a relief reservoir. They are partway. They reached the 50% mark of building this so as to move all the methane, all the natural gas that is in the leaky storage unit to that other relief storage unit. They have also started using up and taking out a lot of natural gas from that reservoir that's leaking. It was 90% full when the leak started, and it's now less than 37% full. And with that, of course, the emission rate of natural gas into the atmosphere has also been reduced substantively. They say by the end of February, they should have that storage unit capped and closed, and the leak will be contained.
What changes in regulatory policy might make a difference going forward, and were regulations in place that should have made a difference prior to?
Actually, there are not many regulations for methane emissions. There is a new proposed EPA regulation to reduce emissions, but the facilities themselves have very little oversight, and I don't believe that it would have happened if more oversight was mandatory. I think that there is a bill calling for regulation of natural gas storage facilities. I don't remember if it's a Senate bill. It's from this past November, but they are calling for more regulation of specifically natural gas storage facilities. So that tells me that, yes, it's needed, and no, it was not really good oversight in place.
I've been talking with Dr. Astrid Caldas. She is a climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. For more information, you can visit their website at ucsusa.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.
The City of Ferguson, Missouri, and the U.S. Justice Department have established guiding principles which, if adopted, Ferguson police officers will be required to follow. They include building community trust, increasing transparency, and strengthening accountability. The Ferguson City Council plans to vote on whether to finalize the agreement February 9th after a series of public meetings to advise area residents of the agreement's details. Referred to as a consent decree, the terms and conditions laid out in the agreement have been discussed behind closed doors since the DOJ began its investigation of the city's police department following Michael Brown's death in the summer of 2014. The agreement covers nearly every aspect of policing and is over 130 pages long. Under the agreement, the city will retain control of both the police department and the municipal court, but they will be required to pay $350,000 for an independent monitor to ensure that these reforms are implemented. A costly lawsuit from the Justice Department is considered likely should the council decide to reject their proposal.
On Wednesday, Governor Jerry Brown stepped up efforts to lower the state's prison population, proposing a November ballot measure that could let thousands of felons out of prison earlier. For the California Report, Marissa Lagos has more.
Governor Jerry Brown is stepping up efforts to lower the state's prison population. Yesterday, he proposed a ballot measure that could let thousands of felons out of prison early. Marissa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government Desk has the details.
The ballot measure would roll back what Governor Brown calls unintended consequences of a major sentencing reform he signed nearly three decades ago when he was first governor. That measure set out predetermined sentences for each crime, tying the hands of judges and the state's parole board.
And one of the key unintended consequences was the removal of incentives for inmates to improve themselves, refrain from gang activity, using narcotics, otherwise misbehaving.
Now, Brown wants to let nonviolent state prisoners who work to better themselves be eligible for parole earlier, which would also help shrink the state's inmate population. The proposed ballot measure would also make a major change to the state's juvenile justice system by allowing judges, instead of prosecutors, to decide whether a minor should be charged as an adult. Brown was joined by law enforcement leaders on a call announcing the ballot initiative. That's a huge change from years past, says UC Berkeley criminal justice expert Barry Crisberg. He's advocated these types of reforms for years.
You're seeing law enforcement leadership beginning to understand the value of these kind of reforms. Not all of them, but a chunk of them. And the governor being on that side helps this move forward.
There are currently about 25,000 people in prison for nonviolent crimes who could eventually benefit if voters approve the measure. But some Republican lawmakers immediately denounced the proposal as a threat to public safety. For the California Report, I'm Marisa Lagos.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder is being scrutinized for his role in the massive poisoning of the Flint public water supply. For the Environment Report, Rebecca Williams has the story.
Looking for answers in Flint. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. In his State of the State address this week, Governor Rick Snyder apologized to people in Flint for the water crisis.
I'm sorry most of all that I let you down. You deserve better. You deserve accountability. You deserve to know that the buck stops here with me. Most of all, you deserve to know the truth. I have a responsibility to tell the truth.
The governor said he would release his emails related to Flint. Those emails came out late yesterday afternoon. Michigan Radio's Mark Brush is here with me. And Mark, there really were no big surprises.
Yeah, I mean, there were no revelations here. We weren't really expecting a bombshell. They pretty much underscored what's already been revealed. And this story all blew up last fall. And that's when state officials stood in front of that sign that said, "Taking Action on Flint Water." One of the things the governor did was to appoint an independent task force to look into what went wrong in Flint. That task force came out with a report and placed most of the blame on the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
And in his State of the State address, Snyder placed blame on the people who work for him. He said last summer his office asked state agencies about the quality of Flint water, test results, and blood testing.
The DEQ told us that Flint was in compliance with the lead and copper rule. They told us there was one concern with one house that was corrected and there was nothing widespread to address. The Department of Health and Human Services also told us that the elevated blood lead levels were to be expected because they followed a normal seasonal trend. These conclusions were later shown to be incorrect.
So the governor said he was getting bad information from his people. The task force that looked into the problems in Flint found what they called a culture of, quote, technical compliance within the Department of Environmental Quality. In other words, they say they did the bare minimum instead of doing what they're supposed to do, which is to protect public health.
Right. The DEQ did not require Flint to treat its water to prevent lead exposure. The task force said a culture change is needed at the DEQ. Snyder seemed to address this in his speech. He said he wanted better communication inside his government.
For those whose mistakes contributed to this disaster, we are fully cooperating with investigations and will hold those individuals accountable. And let me be perfectly clear to all of state government. In situations like this, they must come to my desk immediately. No delays, no excuses, period.
And this is where I wondered, how do you create an atmosphere where you encourage people to speak up when there's a problem? Well, David Mayer can take a stab at that one. He's with the Roth School of Business at the University of Michigan, and he studies ethical issues in organizations. He told me, typically, when someone speaks up, it doesn't go all that well for them.
You know, organizations that want to have cultures where people can speak up have to be really sensitive around this type of information. If stories like, oh, this person who actually spoke up, now we're not hearing from them anymore at all, I think that's a really tough thing to overcome and having employees feel safe.
And we saw this play out with the Flint water crisis. One of the people who uncovered what was going on in Flint was from the EPA. Miguel Del Toro warned his superiors back in April that something was wrong in Flint. Lead could be getting into the water. And he warned regulators here in Michigan. But the state did not listen to those warnings. In fact, a spokesman called Del Toro a rogue employee. And it took another 5 months before the state told people that their water was unsafe.
And that comes back to what our ethics professor David Mayer talks about, that if you want to have a place where people can openly point out problems, you have to reward those people when they do that, by praising them and, most importantly, by doing something about the problem they bring up.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
Mark Brush is part of the team covering the Flint water crisis for Michigan Radio. That's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
A newly published paper suggests that Planet X might not only exist, but that it's statistically certain. Scientists have been looking for Planet X since the early 1800s, after it was suggested that the solar system was acting in a way that suggested there were undiscovered planets having a gravitational effect on the orbits of other planets and comets. Based on calculations and computer simulations, Planet X likely exists over 600 times as far from the Sun as the Earth, and is likely 10 times larger than Earth. You might wonder why such a large object has gone unnoticed. However, the planet takes an estimated 15,000 Earth years to rotate around the Sun, and there is only one telescope on Earth that may be able to detect it. Finding images of the planet has become a priority of the Subaru telescope in Hawaii, and it may take as long as 5 years to gather an image of the planet.
And this winter has seen a spike in snow sports deaths. Experts say it's a combination of weather and snow conditions. The affected areas have weak snowpacks, which can easily lead to avalanches when they can't support the weight of heavier snow on top of them. According to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, 10 people have died in the last 10 days, and 14 have died so far this snow season nationwide.
I work with the Klamath Justice Coalition.
In addition to this, 4 people died last weekend, including 1 in Washington State, 2 in Wyoming, and a snowmobiler was killed in the Whitefish Mountains of Montana.
Nearly 14,000 square feet of coral reef in the Cayman Islands were damaged earlier this week by the anchor chain of Paul Allen's 300-foot yacht. Allen was not on board the vessel at the time of the incident, but his communication team issued a statement announcing that the billionaire won't take responsibility, claiming the crew followed officials' instructions of where to place the vessel. In addition to being a prior owner of the Portland Trailblazers, Allen is one of the co-founders of Microsoft. Local divers contend the damaged area represents some 80% of the West Bay replenishment zone, and officials expect to publish a more detailed findings next week.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Carrick Tribal member Molly Jane Myers. She'll speak on recent victories in the effort to remove dams on the Klamath River. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be somewhere in the 40s with rain. On this day, January 28, 1878, Yale became the first college to produce a daily newspaper. The quote for today comes courtesy of Abraham Lincoln, who said, "The philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next generation."
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The uber-rich like to collect trophies as proof of their unsurpassed uberness. These are not like the tacky brass trophy you won in a bowling tournament. No, no, global ultra-billionaires compete ferociously with each other in extreme wealth games to have the most dazzling trophy wife, the most humongous and elaborate trophy yacht on the seven seas, etc. And now comes the most ostentatious game of one-upsmanship yet, the trophy mansion. Forget those $10 million show houses perched pretentiously atop a peak in Aspen for all to see. We're talking $100 million, $200, $500 million. Mine is bigger than yours, monuments to mammon. For example, a gold rush of developers are constructing monstrous trophy mansions in Los Angeles. How big? My entire house is 1,500 square feet. But these things have 8,000 square foot master bedrooms, closets so vast they include catwalks, full-size IMAX movie theaters, and even champagne rooms. One of these bungalows in the Lux zip code of Bel Air is listed for sale at $500 million. It encompasses 110,000 square feet of indoor space, the size of a shopping mall, plus a bowling alley, a nightclub, a casino, and, get this, 4 swimming pools. Who in their right mind needs 4 swimming pools? Asks a neighbor who paid a mere $10 million or so for his luxurious Bel Air home. Well, sniffed the developer, one can work up quite a sweat going around this maxi mansion, so why would you not need 4 swimming pools? Moreover, note that this $500 million Taj Mahal is not even meant to be the owner's main home, but a place for occasional getaways. Nobody buys a 100,000 square foot home to use every day, explains the developer. This is Jim Hightower saying, such excess is not just an embarrassment of riches, it's obscene.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In 2011, workers in New Jersey conceded to higher pension and health care contributions in exchange for the state funding the pension. But within 3 years, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie reneged on that commitment and has underfunded the pension by $17 billion in the last 4 years. That's on top of many other years where New Jersey also underfunded the pension system. Hedy Rosenstein, New Jersey State Director for the Communications Workers of America, says that without proper funding, the pension plan is 8 to 12 years from going bankrupt.
If the pension doesn't get funded, it will effectively destroy the economy of New Jersey. I don't think there's any legitimate disagreement about that. We are 8 to 12 years away from Armageddon.
Rosenstein says the pension plan and the state economy can be saved in New Jersey without it costing any working person anything.
There have been over $6 billion in tax cuts to millionaires and to very profitable corporations. They can make these payments if they would restore the millionaire's tax, make the payments quarterly, and also stop paying massive fees to invest our pension money in hedge funds.
The City University of New York is claiming labor talks with its faculty are at an impasse. If New York's State Public Employment Relations Board agrees, then a mediator will be appointed to resolve those labor negotiations on a new contract. CUNY Professional Staff Congress President Barbara Bowen said that, quote, having failed to make an economic offer to the union for 5 years and having finally offered what amounts to a salary cut, the City University of New York has now claimed that contract negotiations are at an impasse, end quote. The CUNY Professional Staff Congress says it's reviewing the impasse claim and studying the legal finding before it responds. The union says it will continue to fight to reverse the state's disinvestment in CUNY and its impact on the education of CUNY students. A strike authorization vote is being taken by the union. The National Council for Occupational Safety and Health says public workers in Flint, Michigan should know they're protected by whistleblower laws as well as by civil service rules. With lawsuits, a federal probe, and a state criminal probe underway, National COSHA's Jessica Martinez says these workers should know they're legally protected from retaliation if they come forward and tell what they know about Flint's water poisoning. Martinez says that Flint is a man-made disaster, and the man who made it is Governor Rick Snyder. She says emails and other documents show that Snyder appointees, including former state treasurer Andrew Dillon and former Flint emergency managers Ed Kurtz and Darnell Early, made the decisions that led to the poisoning of Flint's water, and public workers there with testimony to give on that should know that they are legally protected. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In the Caribbean and Latin America, thousands of birth defects have been linked to the quickly spreading Zika virus. The World Health Organization's Director General, Margaret Chan, reported today that the virus, which is transmitted through mosquito bites, has infected over 1 million people in 23 countries so far. Those infected with Zika virus rarely show symptoms. This makes it particularly challenging to detect and then treat the disease. This causes particular distress for pregnant women who are at risk of transmitting the virus's crippling effects to their newborns. Brazil and other countries hit hardest by the outbreak of the virus are targeting and destroying mosquito breeding grounds. There is currently no vaccine to treat the virus medically. Experts say that the virus possesses explosive pandemic potential. They project that as many as 4 million people could be infected by the end of this year.
Today marks International Holocaust Remembrance Day. 11 years ago, the United Nations General Assembly designated the day to commemorate Holocaust victims. The date coincides with the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau extermination camp. The Holocaust refers to the systematic mass murder of more than 6 million Jews by the Nazi regime and its collaborators during the Second World War. In total, 11 million people were murdered during the Holocaust. FSRN's Philip Warwick has more from Warsaw.
It's winter and snow covers the ground at the largest physical memorial to the Holocaust, the former Auschwitz-Birkenau extermination camp. Of the 1.1 million people murdered here, 900,000 were Jews. Prior to World War II, Poland was home to the largest Jewish community in Europe, with a population of more than 3 million. six decades later, estimates put Poland's Jewish population at between 7 and 25,000. Paweł Sawicki, press officer at the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial, says it's hard to convey just how deeply the Holocaust changed Poland socially, culturally and politically.
We talk about great people of Polish culture. Without Polish Jews, Polish culture wouldn't look the same. We are talking about different political groups, and many different streams of Jewish political life was created in Poland. This was the biggest Jewish community in the world.
As early as the 12th century, religious tolerance in Poland set the country apart from many other European kingdoms during the Middle Ages and fostered the rise of the well-established major Jewish population center. The Holocaust destroyed 90% of Poland's Jewish population, and many of the traumatized survivors chose to emigrate to build new lives elsewhere. Michael Szudrycz is the chief rabbi of Poland. He says those survivors who remained in the country and their descendants have also had to contend with secondary social impacts on their communities, from Soviet occupation to gentrification-fueled displacement.
And it's not only Auschwitz. Look at Kazimierz, the old Jewish area of Krakow. I remember it was completely desolate, falling down. It was dangerous 30 years ago to go to Kazimierz, not because of anti-Semitism, because of the drunk and the drug addicts who are hanging out there and all the deserted buildings. Today, you can't afford to rent an apartment. So, did they do it right? Did they not? Clearly, it was bad when it was falling down. Now that it's all gentrified, and it's like the coolest place to live in Krakow, it's also wrong. Well, not the same level of wrong. I'm not comparing it to Auschwitz either. But it's the struggle to try to find the right balance. And I could say, without a doubt, we're not there yet, but we're getting closer.
Krakow is located 150 miles south of Warsaw. From the 15th century on, the city's historical district of Kazimierz was a major Jewish cultural and religious center. Krakow resident Professor Jonathan Weber is a social anthropologist and a former member of the International Council of the Auschwitz Museum. He says the loss of the deeply rooted Jewish population left an immediate vacuum in Polish society, though it wasn't recognized as such during the Soviet occupation.
So when you have a genocide that takes out this population, literally removes it, you've got empty properties, you've got synagogues not being used, you've got cemeteries which are no longer functioning, and you've got a huge economic hole and a gap. And you've then got to educate your young people as to where this all came from and why it happened and how did it happen, etc. And under communism, Soviet communism, which is dominant ideology here, the Soviets didn't want to emphasize the Holocaust as a specifically Jewish phenomenon at all. I mean, so that this was a fascist occupation run by a country which was fundamentally imperialist, that was annexing Polish territory to itself.
Between 1948 and 1950, more than 100,000 Polish Jews immigrated to the newly declared State of Israel. Dr. Michael Kagan is an inventor and author who lives in Jerusalem. Born in the United Kingdom, Kagan moved to Israel when he was 21 years old. He is the son of a Holocaust survivor and is uncomfortable with how his father's experience is used by current Israeli political leaders.
Within society here, there is a very strong tension. You can see that in our political leaders, that they use the Holocaust to create anger, to create shame, that we as a people didn't rise up and fight against it. Guilt, maybe there's collective guilt there as well, but trauma, collective trauma, how do you deal with trauma? And so a lot of the right-wing politics here is born from that sense of victim and not being able to cope with it. Nobody teaches how to deal with trauma.
The memory and trauma of the Holocaust and how it is employed is an extremely sensitive subject in Israel, including among the ranks of the country's politicians. 30-year-old Staff Shafir is Israel's youngest female member of parliament, known as the Knesset.
Well, sadly, only a few months ago, our prime minister tried to change the memory of the Holocaust by giving it a different, newly discovered as he may say, angle to the source and relation to the Israeli or the Jewish-Arab relations, and made a very cynical usage of the Holocaust memory. And I think this is shameful, and it's something that should never be done. It's part of that new narrative building, and the right wing in Israel is doing all the time, changing historical narratives to fit their political agenda. And this is a very risky situation.
Shafir is concerned about revisionist history after Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu publicly accused the former Palestinian Grand Mufti of Jerusalem of convincing Adolf Hitler to exterminate Europe's Jewish population. Netanyahu's statements, made last October at a conference at the World Zionist Organization, sparked international controversy and prompted the office of the German Chancellor to remind the world that the Nazis were in fact responsible for the Holocaust. Back at Auschwitz, that's a lesson that is made clear to millions of people who visit the memorial each year. Few people who experienced the Holocaust firsthand, survivors, perpetrators, or observers, are still alive to share their stories. It's now up to their descendants and memorials like the one at Auschwitz to make sure subsequent generations never forget. Philip Warwick, FSRN, Warsaw.
You've been listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kanan Schlesinger and Ethan Martin. The producer is Robin Ryan. Special thanks to Chris Andre. And our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sari Kametha. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, hosts Ani and Lynn speak with organizer and author Derek Cressman, who will be in town next week to talk about getting big money out of politics. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Per Fagering speaks with David Barsamian of Alternative Radio about the challenges in getting and keeping AR on the airwaves. They also discuss current issues related to Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, and Syria. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Ken Jones speaks with Hari Kondabolu, who the New York Times calls one of the most exciting political comics in stand-up today. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Good night, Sarga.
Good night, Robert.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Kark tribal member Molly Jane Myers has worked with the Klamath Justice Coalition for a decade to hammer out an agreement with the electrical utility Pacific Corps and California state officials in order to remove 4 dams on the Klamath River. This week, the California State Water Board moved forward on an environmental assessment of the dam removal. This gives advocates a sense of cautious optimism. KBOO News spoke with Molly Jane this afternoon about recent victories in her tribe's effort to reclaim the Klamath River.
I work with the Klamath Justice Coalition, which is an organization, a grassroots organization that we started about 12, 13 years ago when we first started working on
and recognizing the need to undam the Klamath. Klamath Riverkeeper is actually a sort of, it's sort of like a sister organization, but it's a nonprofit. Our main focus of our group is nonviolent direct action related to environmental justice on the Klamath.
What's happening with this issue right now?
For the past several years, I would say it must be about 6 or 7 years, we have been working on, when I say we, I mean basin-wide. We were working to take out the dams via two agreements, the KBRA and the KHSA, which had multiple signatories. It was kind of like a compromise document, an agreement, right? So so there was people who didn't agree with the KBRA because of either water allocation issues or there were limited waivers of water rights, and some tribes felt like it was a threat to the sovereignty of the tribes. So there were people that didn't necessarily agree with it, and then there were a lot of people that, that were on board with it. But in the end, the congressional approval didn't happen. So on December 31st, 2015, the KBRA expired. So in the time since then, the month has been, we were sort of approached by PacifiCorps, who is the owner of the dam, and they approached us with an idea that they would sell the dams to a right now we're just calling it a dam removal entity. We're not sure what that company is going to look like. And then we'll be purchasing liability insurance, which was one of the reasons why PacifiCorps really wanted to go through the federal way of taking the dams out, because it would limit their liability. So in this case, we would buy a liability insurance policy.